before he found out, I remember hearing my parents speaking at night, and I heard my father say, "The army will kill him. We can't let it happen. The army will be terrible for him." And it was soon after that we found out that my brother's number was a good one. But my father loved him. I saw this that night. And then I remembered this. There was a Labor Day when my father took me alone. I don't know why I was alone with him. I mean, I don't know where my brother and sister were. To Moline, about 40 miles away. Perhaps he had business there, though it is hard to imagine what possible type of business he had anywhere, let alone in Moline. But I do remember being there with him for the Black Hawk Festival, and we watched the dancing of the Indians. The Indian women stood in a circle around the men, and the women only took little steps while the men danced with much commotion. My father seemed keenly interested in watching the dancing and the festivities. There were candied apples for sale, and I wanted one desperately. I had never had a candied apple. My father bought one for me. It was an astonishing thing for him to have done that. And I remember that I couldn't eat the apple. I couldn't get my small teeth into the red crust. And I felt desolation. And he took it from me, and he ate it. But his brow became furrowed, and I felt that I had caused him worry. I don't remember watching the dancers after that. I remember watching only my father's face, so high above me, and I saw his lips become reddish with the candied apple that he ate because he had to. In my memory, I love him for this, since he did not yell at me or make me feel bad for not being able to eat the apple, but took it from me and ate it himself, even with no pleasure. And I remembered this, that he was interested in what he was watching. He had an interest in it. What did he think of those Indians who were dancing? I said suddenly, as the lights started to come on throughout the city, "Mommy, do you love me?" My mother shook her head, looked out at the lights.
"Whistle, stop."
"Come on, Mom. Tell me." I began to laugh, and she began to laugh, too.
"Whistle, for heaven's sake."
I sat up and, like a child, clapped my hands. "Mom, do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me?" She flicked her hand at me, still looking out the window.
"Silly girl," she said, and shook her head. "You silly, silly girl."
I lay back down and closed my eyes. I said, "Mom, my eyes are closed."
"Lucy, you stop it now."
I heard the mirth in her voice. "Come on, Mom. My eyes are closed." There was a silence for a while. I was happy. "Mom," I said.
"When your eyes are closed," she said.
"You love me when my eyes are closed?"
"When your eyes are closed," she said.
And we stopped the game, but I was so happy. Sarah Payne said, "If there is a weakness in your story, address it head on. Take it in your teeth and address it before the reader really knows. This is where you will get your authority," she said, during one of those classes when her face was filled with fatigue from teaching. I feel that people may not understand that my mother could never say the words, "I love you." I feel that people may not understand. It was all right. It was the next day in the hospital, Monday, when Cookie said I needed just one more X-ray. It would be simple, she said. They'd be up to get me soon. Within an hour, I was back in the room. My mother wiggled her fingers at me, and I wiggled mine back once I returned to my bed. "Piece of cake," I said to her. And she said, "You're a brave girl, Whizzledee." She looked out the window, and I looked out the window, too. We must have spoken more, I'm sure we did. But then my doctor came in hurriedly and said, "We might have to take you to surgery. You may have a blockage. I don't like what I see." "I can't," I said, sitting up. "I'll die if I have surgery. Look how skinny I've gotten." My doctor said, "Except for being sick, you're healthy and you're young." My mother stood up. "It's time for me to go home," she said.
"Mommy, no, you can't," I cried.
"Yes, I've been here long enough, and it's time I go home." My doctor had no response to my mother's remark. I remember only his determination to get me to the next test to see if I needed surgery. And while I would stay in the hospital for almost 5 weeks more, he never asked me about my mother. If I missed her, never said that it must have been nice to have her there. Not one thing about her did he say. And so I never told this kind doctor how I missed her terribly, that her coming was, well, I couldn't have said what it was, and I didn't say anything about it at all. So my mother left that day. She was frightened about how she would find a cab. I asked one of the nurses to help her, but I knew that once she reached First Avenue, no nurse would be able to help her. Already, two male orderlies had brought the gurney into my room, and the bed rail was taken down. I told my mother how to raise her arm, how to say LaGuardia as though she said it often. But I could see that she was terrified. And I was terrified, too. I have no idea if she kissed me goodbye, but I cannot think she would have. I have no memory of my mother ever kissing me. She may have kissed me, though. I may be wrong. I have said that at the time I am writing about, the AIDS disease was a terrible thing. It's still a terrible thing, but people are used to it now. Being used to it is not good. But when I was in the hospital, the disease was new, and no one yet understood how to keep it in abeyance. And so on the door of a hospital room in which a person had this illness would be a yellow sticker. I can remember them still. Yellow stickers with black lines. When I later went to Germany with William, I thought of the yellow stickers in the hospital. They did not say, "Achtung," but they were like that. And I thought of the yellow stars the Nazis made the Jews wear. My mother had left so quickly, and I had been taken away on a gurney so quickly, that when I was suddenly brought out of the big elevator and parked by a wall in a hallway on a different floor, it was surprising to me that I was left there for so long. But what happened is this. I was left in a place where I could see across the hall to a room with that terrible yellow sticker on the partly opened door, and I saw a man with dark eyes and dark hair in the bed, and he was, it seemed to me, staring at me every second. I felt terrible that he was dying, and I knew that dying that way was a terrible death. I was afraid of dying, but I did not have his illness, and he had to know that. They would not have left a patient in the hallway like they left me there had I had that illness. I felt in this man's gaze that he was begging me for something. I tried to look away, to give him privacy, but each time I glanced at him again, he was still staring at me. There are times still I think of those dark eyes in the face of the man lying on that bed, peering at me with what in my memory I think of as despair, begging. I have since then, it's natural as we get older, been with people as they died, and I've come to recognize the eyes that burn, the very last of the body's light to go out. In a way, that man helped me that day. His eyes said, "I will not look away." And I was afraid of him, of death, of my mother leaving me. But his eyes never looked away. I did not have more surgery. Again, my doctor said that he was sorry to have frightened me, but I only shook my head to let him know that I knew he loved me in his doctor way, and that he had only been trying to keep me alive. Every Friday, he said what my mother had heard him say, "Have a good weekend, then, if you can." And every Saturday and every Sunday, he would show up, saying he had another patient to check on, and he was stopping by, therefore, to check on me as well. He only did not come on Father's Day. I was so jealous of his children. Father's Day. I have never met his children, of course. I heard that his son became a doctor, and later, a few years later, when I saw him in his office and it came up in conversation how I was worried about one of my girls not having many friends, he gave me good advice, citing one of his own girls, saying she now had more friends than his other children. And this has turned out to be true for the daughter I was worried about, too. When I had trouble in my marriage, I mentioned it to him briefly. This kind doctor was frightened for me. I do remember I saw that, and that he had no advice to give me. But for those 9 weeks, that spring and summer so long ago now, for 9 weeks, minus one day, Father's Day, this man, this lovely doctor, father man, saw me every day, sometimes twice a day. When I left and the bills came in, he charged me for 5 hospital visits. I want to record that, too. I was worried about my mother. She had not called to tell me she had made it home, and I could only make local calls on the phone by my bed. Or I could make collect calls, which would mean that whoever answered in my childhood home would be asked if they would accept the charges. That is how it was done. An operator would say, "Will you accept the charges of Lucy Barton?" One time only had I called them like this. It was when I was pregnant with my second child and I had had some sort of altercation with William. I have no memory about what. But I missed my mother. I missed my father. I suddenly missed the stark tree in the cornfield of my youth. I missed this all so deeply and terribly that I pushed the stroller with little Chrissy in it to a telephone booth by Washington Square Park, and I called my parents home. My mother answered, and the operator said that Lucy Barton was on the line calling from New York. Would my mother accept the charges? And my mother said, "No. You tell that girl she has money now to spend, and she can spend it on her own." I hung up before the operator had to repeat this to me. And so that night in the hospital, I did not call my parents to see if my mother had gotten home. But William called them from our apartment in the village because I asked him to. And he said yes, she had arrived safely back at her home. "Did she say anything else?" I asked. I was terribly sad. I was as sad, really, as a sad child. And children can be very sad. "Oh, Button," my husband said. "Button. No." The next week, my friend Mala came to visit. She said, sitting right next to the head of the bed, so close it seemed, "Nice to have had your mother here." And I said yes. And she told me that she hated her mother terrifically, and told me the whole story again as though she had not told it to me before, how much she hated her mother, and when she'd had her babies she had to see a psychiatrist because she was saddened by everything her mother had not given her. Mala said all this to me that day, and recording this now, I think of something Sarah Payne had said at the writing class in Arizona. "You will have only one story," she had said. "You'll write your one story many ways. Don't ever worry about story. You have only one." I smiled at Mala as she talked. I was very glad to see her. I asked her finally about my own children. Did they seem terribly distressed I was not around? She said she thought that Chrissy seemed more able to understand. She was the older one, so that would be natural. Chrissy had a long talk on the stoop with Mala, and Mala had listened as Chrissy told her Mommy was sick but getting better. "You did tell her I was getting better, didn't you?" I said, trying to sit up. And Mala said she had. I loved Mala for this, for her concern about my darling Chrissy. I asked her about Jeremy. How was he? And she said she hadn't seen him. He must be away. I told her that was what my husband had said, too. Mala chatted then about other mothers she knew from the park. One was moving to the suburbs. Another was moving uptown. When she left, I was exhausted. But I had been glad to see her. I thanked her for coming. She said, "Of course," and she bent down and kissed my head. My husband came to visit. It may have been a weekend day. I can only think it must have been. He seemed very tired, and he did not say much. He was a big man, but he lay down next to me on my skinny bed and ran his hand through his blonde hair. He turned on the television that hung above the bed. He was paying for me to have it, but because I didn't have one growing up, I think I've never quite understood television. And in the hospital, I seldom put it on because I associated it with people being sick during the day. Whenever I was told to walk the halls for exercise, pushing my little apparatus of IV bags, I saw that most patients just stared at their televisions, and it made me feel very sad. But my husband turned it on, and he lay next to me on the bed. I wanted to talk, but he was tired. We lay quietly that way. My doctor seemed surprised to see him. Perhaps he was not at all surprised, but I thought he seemed that way. And he said something about how nice it was that we could be together like this, and I remember a twing or a twang in my head. I didn't know why. No one knows why until later. I know that my husband came more than that one day to visit me, but it is that day I remember, and so I write it down. This is not the story of my marriage. I cannot tell that story. I cannot take hold of or lay out for anyone the many swamps and grasses and pockets of fresh air and dank air that have gone over us. But I can tell you this. My mother was right. I had trouble in my marriage. And when my girls were 19 and 20 years old, I left their father and we have both remarried. There are days when I feel I love him more than I did when I was married to him. But that is an easy thing to think. We are free of each other, and yet not, and never will be. And there are days when I have such a clear image of him sitting at his desk in his study while the girls played in their room that I almost cry out, "We were a family!" I think of cell phones now. How quickly we are in touch. I remember when the girls were young, I said to William, "I wish there was something we could each wear on our wrists, like a phone, and then we could talk to each other and know where the other was all the time." But that day that he came to see me in the hospital, when we barely spoke, it might have been when he had found out his father had left him no small amount of money in a Swiss bank account. His grandfather had profited on the war and had put no small amount of money into a Swiss bank account, and now that William had turned 35, the money was suddenly his. I learned about this later when I came home. But it must have made William feel strange to think what the money was and what it meant, and he was never a person who could speak easily of his feelings. And so he lay on the bed with me, I who had, as we joked over the years, or perhaps only I joked, I who had come from nothing. When I first met my mother-in-law, she was a great surprise to me. Her house seemed enormous and well-appointed. But over the years, I came to see that it was not so. It was just a nice house, a nice middle-class house. Because she had been a farmer's wife in Maine, and I thought of Maine as smaller in their farms than the Midwestern ones I knew, I had pictured her to look like some of the hired hands' wives. But she didn't look like that. She was a pleasing-looking woman who looked, she was 55, no older than she was, and who moved through her lovely house with ease, a woman who had been married to a civil engineer. The first time I met her, she said, "Lucy, let's take you shopping and buy you some clothes." I did not take offense. I didn't take anything but some surprise. No one had ever said such a thing to me in my life. And I went shopping with her, and she bought me some clothes. At our small wedding reception, she said to a friend of hers, "This is Lucy." She added, almost playfully, "Lucy comes from nothing." I took no offense, and really I take none now. But I think no one in this world comes from nothing. Yet there was this. After I left the hospital, I had recurring dreams that I and my babies were to be killed by the Nazis. Even now, so many years later, I can remember the dreams. In what looked like a locker room, I had my two little girls with me. They were both very young. In the dream, I understood, we all understood, for there were others in this locker room, that we were to be taken and killed by the Nazis. At first we thought that this room was a gas chamber, but we came to understand that instead the Nazis would come and take us to another room, and that would be the gas chamber. I sang to my babies and held them, and they were not afraid. I kept them off in a corner, away from the other people. And the situation was this. I accepted my death, but did not want my children to be afraid. I was terribly scared they would be taken from me. Perhaps they would be adopted by the Germans, for they looked like the little Aryan children they were. I could not bear to think of them mistreated, and there was some sense, a knowledge, in the dream that they would be mistreated. It was the most terrifying dream. It never went beyond that. I don't know how long I had this dream, but I had it as I lived in New York, with some affluence, and as my children were growing and healthy. And I never told my husband that I had this dream. I wrote my mother a letter. I said I loved her, and I thanked her for coming to see me in the hospital. I said I would never forget that she did that. She wrote back to me on a card that showed the Chrysler Building at night. Where she got that card in Amgash, Illinois, I cannot imagine. But she sent it to me and said, I will never forget either. She signed it M. I put the card on my table near the telephone by my bed and looked at it often. I would pick it up and hold it, looking at her handwriting, no longer familiar to me. I still have the card with the Chrysler Building at night that she sent to me. When I was able to leave the hospital, my shoes did not fit. I had not thought that losing weight meant losing it everywhere, but it did, of course, and my shoes were too big on my feet. I packed the card in the bottom of the plastic bag they gave me to put my things in. My husband and I took a taxi home, and I remember that outside the hospital the world seemed very bright, frighteningly bright. And I did feel frightened by that. My children wanted to sleep with me on my first night home, and William said no, but they lay on the bed with me, my two girls. Dear God, I was happy to see my children. They had grown so. Becca had a terrible haircut. She had got gum in her hair, and the family friend who had no children of her own, who had brought them to me in the hospital, had cut her hair for her. Jeremy. I didn't know he was gay. I didn't know he was sick. No, said my husband. He never looked sick the way so many do. And now he was gone. He had died while I was away. I wept steadily, a quiet weeping. On the front stoop I sat while Becca patted my head. Chrissy sometimes sat down next to me, putting her small arms around me, before the girls danced up and down the stairs again. Mala came by and said, "Oh, dear, you've heard about Jeremy." She said it was very bad, a terrible thing to happen to men, and women, she added. She sat with me while I wept. I have thought so often, about the man in the hospital with the yellow sticker on the door, the day my mother left and I was parked in the hallway outside his room. How he looked at me with the dark of his burning eyes, begging and with despair, not letting me look away. It could have been Jeremy. Many times I have thought, I will look it up. It must be in the public records, the day he died and where he died. But I have never looked it up. It was summer when I came home, and I wore sleeveless dresses, and I didn't realize I was so skinny. But I saw people look at me with fear when I went down the street to get food for the children. I was furious that they looked at me with fear. It was not unlike how children on our school bus would look at me if they thought I might sit next to them. The gaunt and bony men
continued to walk by. When I was a child, our family went to the Congregational Church. We were outcasts there as much as anywhere. Even the Sunday school teacher ignored us. Once I came late to the class, the chairs were all taken. The teacher said, "Just sit on the floor, Lucy." Thanksgivings, we went to the activities room in the church and we were given a Thanksgiving dinner. People were nicer to us on that day. Marilyn, whom my mother mentioned in the hospital, was there with her own mother sometimes, and she would serve us the string beans and the gravy and put the rolls on the table with their small plastic-covered butter pads. I think people even sat at a table with us. I don't remember that we were scorned at those Thanksgiving meals. For many years, William and I went to shelters in New York on Thanksgiving and served food we had brought. It never felt to me that I was giving back. It felt like the turkey or the ham we brought with us seemed suddenly very small in the shelters, even if they were not vast, that we went to. In New York, they were not Congregationalists we fed. They were often people of color. And they were sometimes people with mental illness. And William said one year, "I can't do this anymore." And I said that was okay. And I stopped doing it too. But people who are cold, this I cannot stand. I read an article in the newspaper about an elderly couple in the Bronx who could not pay their heating bills, and they sat in their kitchen with the oven on. Every year I have given money so that people won't be cold. William gives money, too. But to record that I give money for people to be warm is something that makes me feel uncomfortable. My mother would say, "Stop your foolish bragging, Lucy damn dog Barton." The kind doctor said it might take a long while for me to gain my weight back. And I remember that he was right, though I don't remember how long the long was. I went to him for checkups, at first every 2 weeks, then once a month. I tried to look nice. I remember I would try on different outfits and look in the mirror to see what he would see. In his office, he had people in his waiting room, people in his examining rooms, then in his own office, a sort of conveyor belt of many kinds of human material. I thought of how many people's behinds he had seen, how different they all must be. I always felt safe with him, felt that he paid attention to my weight and to every detail of my health. One day I waited to go into his office. Wearing a blue dress and black tights, I leaned against the wall just outside. He was speaking to a very old woman. She was carefully dressed. We had this in common, to be clean and carefully dressed for our doctor. She said, "I have flatulence. It's so embarrassing. What can I do?" He shook his head sympathetically. "That's a toughie," he said. For years, my girls would say, "That's a toughie," to something that was a pickle for them. They had heard me tell the story so many times. I don't know the last time I saw this doctor. I went a few times in the years after my hospital stay, and then once when I called for an appointment, they said he had retired, and I could see his associate. I could have written a letter to him to tell him what he meant to me, but there were problems in my life, and my concentration was not good. I never wrote him. I never saw him again. He was just gone. This dear, dear man, this friend of my soul in the hospital so long ago, disappeared. This is a New York story, too. When I was in Sarah Payne's class, A student from another class came to see her. It was at the end of the class, and people sometimes lingered to speak with Sarah. And this student from the other class came in and said, "I really like your work." And Sarah said, "Thank you," and sitting at the table began to pack up her things. "I like the stuff about New Hampshire," the student said. And Sarah gave a quick smile and nodded her head. The student said, moving toward the door as though she would follow Sarah from the room, "I knew someone from New Hampshire once." Sarah, to my eyes, looked bemused. "Did you?" she said. "Yes, Janie Templeton. You never met Janie Templeton, did you?"
"I never did."
"Her father was a pilot for the airlines, Pan Am or something it was back then," said this student, who was not young. "And he had a nervous breakdown, Janie's father. He started to walk around their house, masturbating. Someone told me that later that Janie saw this. Maybe she was in high school, I don't know, but her father started walking around the house just masturbating compulsively." I became freezing cold in the Arizona heat. I had goosebumps all over me. Sarah Payne stood up. "Hope he didn't fly the plane much." "Okay, then." And she saw me and nodded at me. "See you tomorrow," she said. I had never before heard, nor have I heard since, of this thing, as I had called it to myself, happening as it had happened in our home. I think it was the next day that Sarah Payne spoke to us about going to the page with a heart as open as the heart of God. Later, after my first book was published, I went to a doctor who is the most gracious woman I have ever met. I wrote down on a piece of paper what the student said about the person from New Hampshire named Janie Templeton. I wrote down things that had happened in my childhood home. I wrote down things I'd found out in my marriage. I wrote down things I could not say. She read them all and said, "Thank you, Lucy. It will be okay." I saw my mother only one time after she came to see me in the hospital. It was almost 9 years later. Why didn't I go there to visit her? To visit my father and my brother and sister? To see the nieces and nephews I had never seen? I think, to say it simply, it was easier not to go. My husband would not come with me, and I didn't blame him. And I know the defensiveness in this sentence. My parents and my sister and my brother never wrote me or called me, and when I called them, it was always hard. I felt I heard in their voices anger, a habitual resentment, as though they were silently saying, "You are not one of us," as though I had betrayed them by leaving them. I suppose I had. My children were growing. They needed something all the time. My 2 or 3 hours a day in which to write were terribly important to me. And then my first book was being readied to publish. But my mother became ill, and so I was the one then who went to her hospital room in Chicago to sit at the foot of her bed. I wanted to give her what she had given me, the kind of wide-awake constancy of attentiveness of those days she had been with me. My father greeted me when I stepped off the elevator in the hospital, and I would not have known who he was, except for the gratitude I saw in the eyes of this stranger that I had come to help him. He looked so much older than I had ever thought he could be,
and any anger I felt, or that he felt, did not seem connected to us anymore. The disgust I had had for him most of my life was not there. He was an old man in a hospital who had a wife who was going to die. "Daddy," I said, staring at him. He wore a wrinkled collared shirt and jeans. I think he was too shy at first to hug me, so I hugged him and imagined the warmth of his hand against the back of my head. But in the hospital, that day, he did not, in fact, put his hand across the back of my head, and something inside me, deep, deep inside, heard the whisper, "Gone." My mother was in pain. She was going to die. This was not something I seemed able to believe. My children were by then teenagers, and I was worried, especially about Chrissy, whether she was smoking too much weed. So I was on the phone to them frequently. And the second evening, as I sat near my mother, she said to me quietly, "Lucy, I need you to do something." I stood and went to her. "Yes," I said, "tell me." "I need you to leave." She said this quietly, and I heard no anger in her voice. I heard her decisiveness. But truly, I felt panic. I wanted to say, "If I leave, I will never see you again. Things have been hard with us, but don't make me leave. I can't bear to never see you again." I said, "Okay, Mom, okay. Tomorrow?" She looked at me, and tears pooled in her eyes. Her lips twitched. She whispered, "Now, please, honey, please." "Oh, Mommy," she whispered, "whistle, please." "I'll miss you," I said, but I was starting to cry, and I knew she could not stand that, and I heard her say, "Yes, you will." I bent and kissed her hair, which was matted from her being sick and in bed, and then I turned and took my things, and I did not look back. But when I stepped through the door, I could not keep walking. I backed up without turning around. "Mommy, I love you," I called out. I was facing the hallway, but her bed was the closest to me, and she would have heard me, I am sure. I waited. There was no answer, no sound. I tell myself she heard me. I tell myself, I've told myself this many times. Immediately, I went to the nurse's station. I said, begging, "Please don't let her suffer." And they told me they would not let her suffer. I didn't believe them. There had been the woman in the room dying when I was first having my appendix out, and that woman had been suffering. "Please," I begged these nurses. And I saw in their eyes the deepest fatigue of people who cannot do any more about anything. In the waiting room was my father, and when he saw my tears, he shook his head quickly. I sat by him and whispered what my mother had said, that she needed me to leave. "When will the service be?" I asked. "Oh, please, tell me when it is, Daddy. I will come right back." He said there would be no service. I understood. I felt I understood. "People would come, though," I said. "She's had those sewing customers, and people would come." My father shook his head. "No service,"
he said. And there was no service for her. Or for him, the next year when he died from pneumonia, he would not let my brother take him to a doctor. I flew to see him only days before he died, staying in the house I had not seen for so many years. It frightened me, the house, its smells and its smallness, and the fact that my father was so ill and my mother gone. Gone! Daddy, I said, sitting on the bed by him. Daddy? Oh, Daddy, I'm sorry. I said that again and again. Daddy, Daddy, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry, Daddy. And he squeezed my hand. His eyes were so watery, his skin so thin, and he said, Lucy, you've always been a good girl. What a good girl you've always been. I am quite certain he said this to me. I believe, though I am not sure, that my sister left the room then. My father died that night, or rather very early the next morning at 3 o'clock. I was alone with him, and when I heard the sudden silence, I stood and looked at him and said, Daddy, stop it. Stop it, Daddy. When I got back to New York after seeing my father and my mother the year before, after seeing them for the last time, the world began to look different to me. My husband seemed a stranger. My children in their adolescence seemed indifferent to much of my world. I was really lost. I could not stop feeling panic, as if the Barton family, the five of us, off-kilter as we had been, was a structure over me I had not even known about until it ended. I kept thinking of my brother and my sister and the bewilderment in their faces when my father died. I kept thinking how the five of us had had a really unhealthy family. But I saw then, too, how our roots were twisted so tenaciously around one another's hearts. My husband said, "But you didn't even like them." And I felt especially frightened after that. My book received good reviews, and suddenly I had to travel. People said, "How crazy, such an overnight success." I was on a national morning news show. My publicist said, "Act happy. You are what these women who are getting dressed for work want to be, so you get on that show and you act happy." I have always liked that publicist. She had authority. The news show was in New York, and I was not as scared as people assumed I would be. The business of fear is a funny business. I was in my chair with my microphone attached to my lapel, and I looked out the window and I saw a yellow taxi and I thought, I am in New York. I love New York. I am home. But when I traveled to other cities, as I had to do, I was terrified almost constantly. A hotel room is a lonely place. Oh, God, it is a lonely place. This was right before email became the common way for people to write one another. And when my book came out, I received many letters from people telling me what the book had meant to them. I received a letter from the artist of my youth telling me how much he liked the book. Every letter I received, I answered. But I never answered his. When Chrissy left for college, then Becca the next year, I thought, and it's not an expression, I'm saying the truth, I did think I would die. Nothing had prepared me for such a thing.
And I have found this to be true. Certain women feel like this, that their hearts have been ripped from their chests. And other women find it very freeing to have their children gone. The doctor who makes me not look like my mother, she asked me what I did when my daughters went to college, and I said, my marriage ended. I added quickly, but yours won't. She said, it might. It might. When I left William, I did not take the money he offered me, or the money the law said was mine. In truth, I didn't feel I deserved it. I wanted only for my daughters to have enough, and that was agreed upon right away, that they would have enough. I also felt uncomfortable about where the money came from. I could not stop thinking the word Nazi. And for myself, I didn't care about having the money. Also, I had made money. What writer makes money? But I had made money, and I was making more. And so I didn't think I should have William's money. But when I say, and for myself, I didn't care, I mean this, that to be raised the way I was, with so little, only the inside of my head to call my own, I did not require much. Someone else raised in my circumstances would have wanted more, and I didn't care. I say I didn't care, and yet I happened to get money because of the luck I had with my writing. I think of my mother in the hospital saying that money had not helped Elvis or Mississippi Mary. But I know that money is a big thing. In a marriage, in a life, money is power. I do know that. No matter what I say or what anyone says, money is power. This is not the story of my marriage. I have said that I cannot write the story of my marriage. But sometimes I think about what first husbands know. I married William when I was 20 years old. I wanted to cook him meals. I bought a magazine that had fancy recipes, and I gathered the ingredients. William passed through the kitchen one evening and looked at what was in the frying pan on the stove. Then he came through the kitchen again. "Button?" he said. "What's this?" I said it was garlic. I said the recipe called for a clove of garlic to be sautéed in olive oil. With gentleness, he explained that this was a bulb of garlic and that it needed to be peeled and opened into the cloves. I can picture the unpeeled big bulb of garlic now, so clearly, sitting in the middle of the olive oil in the frying pan. I stopped trying to cook once the girls came along. I could cook a chicken, get them a yellow vegetable every so often, but in truth, food never has held much appeal for me as it does for so many people in this city. My husband's wife loves to cook. My former husband is what I mean. His wife loves to cook. The husband I have now grew up outside of Chicago. He grew up in great poverty. At times their home was so cold they wore their coats inside. His mother was in and out of mental institutions. "She was crazy," my husband tells me. "I don't think she loved any of us. I don't think she could." When he was in the fourth grade, he played a friend's cello, and he has played with brilliance since. All his adult life, my husband has played the cello professionally, and he plays for the Philharmonic here in the city. His laugh is huge, walloping. He is happy with anything I make for us to eat. But there is one more thing I would like to say about William. During those earlier years of my marriage, he took me to see Yankee games.
This was in the old stadium, of course. He took me, and a couple of times the children, to see the Yankees play, and I was surprised at the ease with which he spent the money on the tickets. I was surprised at how he said to go ahead and get a hot dog and beer. And I shouldn't have been surprised. William was generous with his money. I understand that my surprise was because of how it was when my father bought me a candied apple. But I watched those Yankee games with an awe I still remember. I had known nothing about baseball. The White Sox had meant little to me, although I felt a kind of allegiance to them. But after these Yankee games, I loved only the Yankees. The diamond. I remember being amazed by it, and I remember watching the players hit and run, watching the men who came out to roll the dirt clean, and most of all I remember watching the sun as it set, hitting the buildings nearby, the buildings of the Bronx. The sun would hit these buildings, and then different city lights would come on, and it was a thing of beauty. I felt I had been brought into the world, is what I am saying. Many years later, after I had left my husband, I would walk to the East River by 72nd Street, where you can go right up to the river, and I would look up the river and think of the baseball games we had gone to long before, and feel a sense of happiness, in a way that I could not feel about other memories of my marriage. The happy memories hurt me, is what I am saying. But the memories of the Yankee games were not like that. They made my heart swell with love for my former husband and New York. And to this day, I am a Yankees fan, though I will never again go to a game. I know this. That was a different life. I think of Jeremy telling me I had to be ruthless to be a writer. And I think how I did not go visit my brother and sister and my parents because I was always working on a story and there was never enough time. But I didn't want to go either. There never was enough time. And then later I knew if I stayed in my marriage I would not write another book, not the kind I wanted to. And there is that as well. But really, the ruthlessness, I think, comes in grabbing on to myself, in saying, this is me, and I will not go where I can't bear to go, to Amgash, Illinois. And I will not stay in a marriage when I don't want to. And I will grab myself and hurl onward through life, blind as a bat, but on I go. This is the ruthlessness, I think. My mother told me in the hospital that day that I was not like my brother and sister. Look at your life right now. You just went ahead and did it. Perhaps she meant that I was already ruthless. Perhaps she meant that. But I don't know what my mother meant. My brother and I speak every week on the telephone. He has stayed living in the house we grew up in. Like my father did, he works on farm machinery. But he does not seem to get fired or have my father's temper. I have never mentioned his sleeping with pigs before they are slaughtered. I have never asked him if he still reads the books of a child, those about people on the prairie. I don't know if he has a girlfriend or a boyfriend. I know almost nothing about him. But he speaks to me politely, though he never once has asked me about my children. I have asked him what he knew of my mother's childhood, if she had felt in danger. He says he doesn't know. I told him of her catnaps in the hospital. Again, he says he doesn't know. When I speak on the phone to my sister,
She is angry and complains about her husband. He doesn't help with the cleaning or the cooking.